Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Tonight is January the 19th. We are in Parshas Mishpatim, page 436. And we are up to Pasuk Yudalit 14. Shalosh Rigolim Tachog Li Bashana, three times, or three holidays, three times you should celebrate or make for me in the year. How do they translate it here? Celebrate. Three pilgrimage festivals. The word regal means foot. It can mean time, but the reason why it's used over here rather than zmanim or something like that is because the mitzvah is to go up, to walk up to Yerushalayim, to go to Yerushalayim. So that involves movement, so one has to go there, and therefore the word regalim is used. So there are three of them in the year. This is the first time in the Torah that they're introduced. They come up several times in the Torah, but this is the first one. Eschag ha-matzos tishmor. So the holiday of matzos you should guard, which means you should make sure to do it right. And what is that? Shivas yamim tochal matzos. 7 days you should eat matzos. Kasher tzivisicha, as you were commanded. Lemoed chodesh aviv, at the time of the month of the aviv. Aviv means blossoming. Kivo yatsasa mimitzrayim, for that is when you came out of Egypt. Velo yera'uf anayrekam, and you shall not see my face empty-handed, or empty. It means empty-handed, it means empty. We'll come back to this, we'll read a little further. Now, Pesach has already been mentioned. As we know, when we came out of Egypt, the end of Parshas Bo, Pesach was discussed. The other Yomim Tovim have not been mentioned. The Chag HaKotzir, the holiday of the
harvest,
right? Bikurei Ma'asecha, the first fruits of your deeds, how do they say it here?
First fruits of your labor.
First fruits of your labor, okay. Asher tizra that you plant in the field. Fechag ha'asif b'tzeis ha'shana, and the holiday of gathering at the end of the year as the year goes out. Be'aspecha es ma'asecha min ha'sadeh, when you gather your labor, I guess they call it, from the field. So these last two are, of course, Shavuos and Sukkos. Shalosh pelamim bashana, three times a year. Yeroech olzokorecha, all of your males shall be seen. El tenei ha'adon Hashem, to the face of the Master Hashem. Lo tizbach al chametz dam zivchi, do not slaughter with chametz the blood of my sacrifice. V'lo yalin chelev chagi, and the fat of, again, my sacrifice, another word for sacrifice, should not stay overnight ad boker, till morning. It means burn it before the morning. Reishis bikurei ad mascha, the first of the fruits of your land. Tavi beis Hashem elokecha, you shall bring to the house of Hashem your God. That's the mitzvah of bikurim. Lo sevashel gedi b'chalev imo, do not cook a kid in the milk of its mother.
Yeah.
Now we have basar b'chalev, milk and meat together. There's the first of a few places which it's mentioned in the Torah. So we already know about Pesach, as was mentioned. Shavuos and Sukkos are being introduced here for the first time. So let's go back though and see what are the points about Pesach that are emphasized here. So the Torah says there are three regalim, three festivals that you need to go up to Yerushalayim that you should celebrate during the year. So Chag HaMatzos, the holiday of Matzos, you shall guard. Now, you shall guard, they say you shall observe. Okay, the word shomer means to guard. So you shall guard, the simple meaning is, as they write, to observe it. Keep the holiday. Make sure you do it right. Which means do whatever the laws of the holiday are. So one should not eat chametz. One should not do any malacha, any creative work on the first and last days of Pesach. And then we have all of the rules involving this Seder, etc. And, of course, the Karban Pesach. So, you should keep the holiday of Pesach. But in addition to the observance of the laws, there is a keeping of the holiday itself, which means to make sure that the holiday occurs. Now, how do you make sure the holiday occurs? The holiday is going to occur whether you like it or not. It just happens. So in what way do you ensure that the holiday occurs, that it should happen? So, as the Torah continues, 7 days you should eat matzos, as you were commanded, at the time of the month of the Aviv. They say the springtime. We will find in a few places in the Torah there is a commandment to make sure that Pesach falls in the spring and not at a different time. And this brings to light the issue of the lunar calendar. We've discussed this a little bit before, and most everyone is familiar with the need to synchronize the lunar calendar and the solar calendar. But let's give it a little bit of attention now with the Chodesh Ha'aviv, the month of the spring, or the month of sprouting, of growing. We know that we Jews follow a lunar calendar, which means all of our holidays are lunar calendar dates. The Pesach is on the 15th of the lunar month of Nisan, and Rosh Hashanah is the first day of the lunar month of Tishrei, and Sukkot is the 15th day of the lunar month of Tishrei. We're aware of this. The lunar month, there is nothing that dictates how many lunar months there are in the year, because there's no celestial time of a year regarding the moon. The moon revolves around the earth in 30 days, 29 and a half days, whatever it is. That's how long it takes for the moon to go around the earth. It keeps on doing that over and over and over and over and over again. There's nothing to say that 12 of those is a year, because there's no time frame of a year when you are counting by the moon. On the other hand, if you follow the sun, then there is something called a year, because it takes 365 days and a little bit longer, 365 and a quarter or so, for the earth to revolve around the sun. And this is something which you can measure, because the length of the day changes as the year moves on. It gets shorter and gets longer as time goes on. And where the sun rises on the horizon and where the sun sets on the horizon also changes. So if you take the 2 days that are precisely the same, meaning it's the same length of day, the same time, the same place the sun rises on the horizon, the same place the sun sets on the horizon, and that it's the same, that we're either heading lower or heading higher. So if you factor all that together, all that only happens once a year for each day, meaning that today's day, the sun rose at about 7:40 in the morning in Atlanta, Georgia, and it set at approximately 5:45 or so in Atlanta, Georgia, and you can mark the point on the horizon where it rose and where it set, and we are at a stage in the calendar where the day is getting a little bit longer. Now, if you factor all those things in, the length of the day, where the sun rose, where the sun set, and whether the day now is getting longer, I mean, tomorrow is going to be a little bit of a longer day, all that only happens once a year. This same set of rules that we just set up for today, it rose at 7:40 in Atlanta, Georgia, set at 5:45, you can point to the place on the horizon where it rose and where it set, and that tomorrow the day is going to be a little bit longer, you punch all that into the computer, that's only going to come up once a year. This same exact circumstance will only come up again next year around this time. Now, I don't want to say January 19th, because that's not necessarily exactly right, but close. So if you follow a solar calendar, you have a time frame called a year, but you do not have any time frame called a month. There is no month if you follow a solar calendar. I realize that in our secular dating, we use months, January, February, March, but they're completely arbitrary. There is nothing that says when January should start and when it should end, and when February should start and when it should end, and why January is 31 days and February is 28 days. That is completely arbitrary just in order to get 12 of those things in order to reach 365 days per year and 366 in a leap year. But there's nothing in the heavens that you can point to when you use a solar calendar that determines months. You have seasons. You have, excuse me?
Just
days. Days. You have days, you have years, and you have seasons, because we have, at least if you're in a place which is affected by the seasons, which is most areas on Earth, that the climate changes. And the climate can be gauged. Seasons don't have, at least based on looking at the sun, they don't have an exact start time and an exact end time, even though in halacha we do put an exact start time and end time on the seasons. But just by observing the sun, you're not going to come up with an exact start and exact end. Although we do have the two solstice, I don't know if the plural of solstice is solstice, and the two equinox or equini or equinoxes, I don't know how you say it in plural. So you do have that. The summer solstice is the beginning of the summer, the winter solstice is the beginning of the winter, and the spring equinox is the beginning of spring, and the fall equinox is the beginning of fall. So you could use those determinants. The equinox is the time when the day and night are exactly the same amount of time, 12 hours, and the solstice is the longest day is the summer solstice, the longest night is the winter solstice. So you could use those to determine the seasons. But again, there is no way to determine a month using a purely solar calendar, just as there's no way to determine a year using a purely lunar calendar. Now, what you can do is you can arbitrarily say that when 12 lunar months pass, we're going to call that a year. You can do that. Where'd you get the number 12 from? Right? Now, what I just told you is not really true. What I just told you is not really true. It's sort of true, but it's not really true. Because we have to factor in the stars. The stars are the constellations, and the constellations. I realize some of you may be familiar with this, but for those who aren't, it really is. It's something which people who are not familiar with this, it's a brand new thought. So those who are familiar, please bear with us. The if you follow the pattern of the stars in the sky. And I have to preface my remarks by saying to you that because of my poor eyesight, I can't see except the brightest stars. So I've never done this myself other than in a computer program and only reading about it in a book. But I am familiar with how it works. If you follow the process of these stars, the stars rise and set, just like the sun and the moon rise and set. And they rise and set in a predictable pattern, and they rise and set along a particular arch so that some stars have a very short arch in the sky. They'll rise and set very quickly. Some stars will rise and go very high in the sky and then set. Now, the sun, it depends on the time of year. In the winter time, the sun's arch is very small. It doesn't get that high up in the sky. It gets up a little bit and then goes back down. Whereas in the summertime, the sun gets almost directly overhead. In Atlanta, Georgia, it never gets to actually directly overhead because we're beyond the tropics. Once you're beyond the tropics, it never gets directly overhead. But it's very close to being directly overhead in the summertime. So the length of the day, the reason why it's so much longer, or I should say, I don't know which one you're going to say is the reason of it, but a factor in it being very long is that it has a much bigger arch, and it stays up much, much longer than in the wintertime. The moon is the converse rule. In the winter time, it has a very high arch, stays up for a much longer period of time, whereas in the summer, where the nights are shorter, the moon has a very much shorter arch. It's much lower. It doesn't get that high up in the sky. The sun and the moon are on the same path, shall we say. They're following the same path. It's just that where the sun is in the summer, that's where the moon is in the winter. And where the moon is in the summer, that's where the sun is in the winter. They're on the same path. You can chart where they are. They're on the same path. That's why you occasionally have an eclipse, both of the sun and of the moon, because they're on the same path, and sometimes they'll line up with each other perfectly. That's how you have those eclipses, because they're on the same path. The other stars in the sky also have a pattern, and at different seasons, they'll either have a smaller arch or a larger arch. Some of them are on the same path as the sun and the moon. There are some that are within the same path of the sun and the moon. Those are what are commonly known as the zodiac. Those are the stars that are in the same, if you would draw figuratively, if you would draw different paths in the sky, different arches in the sky, the stars of the zodiac follow the same path as the sun and the moon.
Alongside them, or they could bump into them?
We'll talk about that in a minute. You can't see stars when the sun is visible. The sun is too bright.
Okay.
The stars are there, but you can't see them because the sun is too bright. You can't see anything else.
Sometimes
you can see the moon when the moon is full, and towards morning or towards evening, you can see the moon even when the sun is up. But stars, you can't.
Right.
You have to have a very, very bright item if the sun is up. But they're in the same. The stars are in the same path as the sun and the moon. Those of the zodiac. That is one form of what we call in Hebrew mazalos, as in mazel tov. Mazel means constellation. So those stars, they're in the same path as the sun. That is one form of mazel. It's not the only form of mazel. There's a whole different. We'll call it paradigm of mazel, which has nothing to do with this, which has to do with the planets, actually. But that's a separate discussion. But in terms of the stars, the stars that are in the path of the sun and the moon are considered to be more significant stars than other stars. Now, just so you can understand this, for those who might be a little bit lost, or if it's a brand new concept for you, the reason why the North Star was the star which was used for navigation, you could still use it for navigation. The reason why is because the North Star, because of where it's situated, when you're in the Northern Hemisphere, particularly when you're in the Northern Atlantic Ocean, the North Star has almost no arch. You can see it, and it's there, and it has almost no arch. It's just there. Now, the truth is it has a very, very tiny arch. It's actually moving around in a circle, but very, very tiny. That's why it's so good for navigation. Because every day of the year, it's exactly in the same spot. That's not like the sun and the moon. The North Star is most definitely not in the path of the sun and the moon. The North Star is on a path all by itself, all the way up in the north, and it just has this tiny, tiny circle that it goes around throughout the year. So that's why it's perfect for navigation, because you know where the North Star is. All other stars, depends on the time of year, you got to know your astronomy to know where certain stars should be at certain times. But not so the North Star. That's why it was so good. It's navigation, quote unquote, for dummies. It's there, and you can see, and you're good. You don't need anything else. So that's the advantage of the North Star. Of course, if it's cloudy, you're stuck. But that was the form of navigation, because it was that star that doesn't almost has no path. It has no arch. It just sits there almost. It's, as I said, it is moving, but it's moving very, very slightly. The other stars follow different paths. Some follow the path of the sun and the moon, and those are what we call the mazalos, the zodiac. Using the mazalos, you can, if you're going to call, if the question is, what are you going to call those mazalos, the stars? Are you going to refer to them as a solar item or a lunar item? We're talking about just observing the sun. You can follow what a day is, and you can follow what a year is, but there are no months. There are seasons. There's the solstice and the equinox, but there's no real months. Just following the moon, there are months, but there's no years. The question is, where are we going to place the stars? Is that considered to be a lunar item or a solar item? The reason why this matters is because the zodiac, those stars, if you break them up into separate constellations, which almost everybody does, so you know the springtime you have what we call Tle, which they call Aries, that's the sheep, and then you have what we call the Shor, or the bull, or what they call Taurus, right? You have different. So those those constellations, they rise at the beginning of the night and set at the end of the night at different times of the year, which means that the constellation of Teleh, of what they call Aries, rises in the beginning of the night and is up the entire night. It sets at the end of the night around the time of the spring, around Nisan time. Whereas the next one, the Shor, the Taurus, the bull, that one rises and sets, rises in the beginning of the night, sets at the end of the night, around the time of Iyar, of the second month of the year. So that you can chart months without the moon by looking at the stars. Now you got to know the stars. You got to know which ones you're supposed to look for. But if you know the stars, you can figure out what month it is by which of those constellations are rising in the beginning of the night and setting at the end of the night. So there is another way of quote-unquote months, which means that those constellations are generally broken up into 12 different constellations, and they follow this pattern of each one has its month, which means approximately a 30-day time span. It's actually a little more than a 30-day time span, in which it rises in the beginning of the night and sets at the end of the night. So there is some method other than the sun and the moon to break the year up into 12 parts. There is a way to do that. You see, though, that it's a little bit more complicated, especially because how do you know exactly where one constellation ends and the next one starts, right? Now, that goes back to very ancient times, that to know where the beginning of one constellation is and the end of the other one is. But if you do have that system broken down, then you do have roughly 12 parts without observing the waxing and waning of the moon. Incidentally, the moon itself, just to be aware of this, rises in the beginning of the night and sets at the end of the night only when it's full. A lot of people misunderstand how the moon works. The moon is not up the entire night, most of the month. The moon rises at sunset and sets at sunrise only when it's a full moon. In the beginning of the month, the moon rises at sunrise and sets at sunset, meaning it's right along with the sun. That's why you can't see it, because it's rising with the sun and setting with the sun, so you can't see it. In the middle of the month, then it's rising when the sun goes down, and it's setting when the sun comes up. When you have different times of the month, in addition to only being able to see a crescent rather than the entire moon, but you also can only see it for a few hours a night. Right now, since we've passed Tu B'Shvat, tonight is already, where are we at? Well, today is already the 20th of the month of Shvat. So the moon did not rise at 5:45 when the sun went down. The moon is only starting to rise right about now, most likely, is when the moon is rising. And it will be up when you get up early in the morning. Tomorrow morning, sunrise is only at 7:40. So if you're up before 7:40, you go outside, as long as you don't have obstructions on the horizon, you'll be able to see the moon nicely. It actually won't even be down on the horizon. It'll be slightly higher up. The reason why you won't be able to see the moon at 10 o'clock in the morning is not because it will have set. It's because the sun will be too bright. But it won't actually set because it won't set until later. Maybe about 10, 11 o'clock in the morning is when it's going to set tomorrow morning. So the moon also does not rise and set according to... It's not every day the same way. It depends on the time of the month. At any rate, putting all that together, so if you use a strictly lunar calendar, if that's what you use, then there is no way to determine a year. So that in addition to the fact that if you count 12 lunar months, that's still going to be fewer days than the solar year, and that's what the Arabs do. The Arabs count 12 lunar months, and for them, that's a year. They don't bother calibrating the lunar year together with the solar year. So they end up every year losing 11 days. So that means their calendar is faster than our calendar. It's moving faster. So their holidays get earlier and earlier every year. Every year their holidays are 11 days earlier than they were the year before. Every year, it's 11 days early, 11 days early, 11 days early. And it'll go around the seasons, around the calendar. So that they could have a holiday that falls in April this year, and then 3 years from now it'll fall in beginning of March. And 3 years later it'll fall in the beginning of February. And 3 years later it'll fall in the beginning of January. Because it's losing 11 days every year. But even that is arbitrary. Because why do they pick 12 lunar months? They could have picked 15 lunar months. They could have picked 8 lunar months to be a year. Why pick 12 lunar months? So the only answer can be the seasons. But the seasons is really a sun thing, not a moon thing. So if you pick 12, you really are acknowledging the sun. You're not just solely choosing the moon. If you're really going to solely choose the moon, then what you're going to do is you're not going to keep 12 of them at all. Your year is going to be 30 days long. You're going to say, every month, that's my entire time frame. That's it. There is nothing else. That's it. It's just every month, I start over again. If you're strictly going to go with the moon. But once you factor in seasons or the constellations, then you end up with a longer time frame, and then you pick 12 is usually the one that's picked. So that's what the Arabs do. The secular world doesn't bother with the moon at all. They just bother with the sun, 365 days, with the seasons, but the months are completely arbitrary. The January starts and ends, February, that there are 12 of them, totally irrelevant. It could have just as easily said that instead of 12 months of 30 days each, there could have been 6 months of 60 days each. It's all the same. What difference does it make? All you want is make sure you get 365 days in the year. And instead of February being 28 days, and August being 31 days, it could have been the reverse. February would be 31 days and August would be 28 days. Doesn't make a difference. The point is that there should be 365 days in the year so that the seasons continually start over again. And that the sun is in the same place when the year starts as it was last year. That's all that's happening. What we do is we acknowledge we primarily use the moon. The moon is our dating system. Our calendar is the moon. 12 lunar months is a year. 12 lunar months is a year. But we acknowledge the fact that we have to keep up with the solar year as well. And that's where we add leap months. We add a leap year. We add a month in. This year is a leap year. There's two others this year. And we add that in when we're falling behind in the calendar. So this year, as you know, we had a very early Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah was September 5th. This is the earliest type of year there is in the calendar, which means that Rosh Hashanah could theoretically fall a little bit earlier than September 5th, but it's only in this type of year. In this cycle of the years, as the years move on, and some are later, some are earlier, this is the earliest type year that there is. I don't want to get into different types. That's way beyond tonight's discussion. But this is the earliest type year there is. You will not have a Rosh Hashanah as early as this for the next 19 years. But because we're so early, it's necessary this year, it's critical this year, to add in an extra month. Because if not, next year, Rosh Hashanah will end up in August, and that's not such a big deal. But this year, Pesach would have ended up in the beginning of March. That's what would have happened. If we wouldn't add in this extra month this year, Pesach would end up in the beginning of March. And that's unacceptable. Why is it unacceptable? Because it says that it's Chodesh Ha'aviv. It has to be the month of the blossoming, the month of growing, which is the time of the spring. And so you have to guard Pesach. You don't just have to guard it that when Pesach starts, that you should make sure to keep all the laws. You have to guard Pesach itself to make sure that Pesach comes out at the right time. The part of it is also because we know Nisan has to be the first. Nisan has to be the first. So, therefore, as was mentioned, Adar is the last month that you can do something to, and it gives time to figure out, because right now the calendar is set. It was set by Hillel, not the famous Hillel of the of snowstorm fame, not that Hillel. Many Hillel and Shammah, not that Hillel. Many, many years later, he had a descendant who's called Hillel HaKatan, Hillel the small, the much later.
Same family.
He was a descendant of that Hillel HaZaken, and he, recognizing that there was not going to be any more setting the calendar by witnesses seeing the moon, realizing that wasn't going to happen anymore, he set the calendar, which was a mathematical,
genius.
It's just unbelievable what he was able to do. So that being all set up today, it's all done already for us. But in the time when it wasn't a set calendar like this, so there was wiggle room. It didn't have to be, you know, year X. It could be year Y. And the sages were able to decide, was it going to be this? And, you know, depending on different factors, they would move the extra month, meaning the year with the extra month, depending on what was happening, right? And with various rules governing how flexible they could be.
So if the Arab calendar is strictly lunar, and
strictly lunar, because they are counting 12.
Yeah.
So
like if we're in 2014 now, is their year different?
Yeah. Well, they don't count anyway. They wouldn't acknowledge 2014 because 2014 years from what? They're not counting from that anyway.
Oh, okay.
So, you know. But it does mean that when an Arab says that he is 90 years old, we would say he's probably more like 87.
Really?
Do you
think it that far?
Yeah. There were discrepancies when various Arabs who have become famous when they die or otherwise that when their age is written in the paper.
Yeah.
So there's always a question of what that means exactly.
I've never knew that.
And it doesn't matter if he's 20 years old, but if he's 80, 90 years old, there's going to be a discrepancy. Okay, so you need to guard Pesach, not only the laws of Pesach, but also to make sure that it happens at the right time. And the Torah writes, again, looking again at Pasuk Tezva, verse 15, Kivo Yatzasam Yimitzrayim, because that's when you left Egypt. So Hashem wants us to have the holiday at the time when we left Egypt, not at a different time of the year. Why is that? Because Hashem took us out at the best time to travel. It wasn't too cold, and it wasn't too hot, and it wasn't too muddy. It was the perfect time of year to leave. So because He took us out at the perfect time, Hashem wants us to remember that there was a chesed from Hashem, not only taking us out, but making sure it was the best time to travel. So make sure that Pesach falls at the right time, so that it calibrates perfectly. Now, there's also a mitzvah, though it does not say it over here, that Sukkot should fall in the fall. That should come out in the fall. So again, you'd mess that up too if you didn't have the leap months. If you didn't add a month, you'd end up with Sukkot in the middle of the summer. That would also be a problem. So Pesach must be in the spring, Sukkot must be in the fall. And that same pasuk concludes, Lo yeru fanai reikam, they shall not see my face empty-handed, which means we have to bring sacrifices. When we go to Be'ola Regel, to go up to Yerushalayim for the holidays, we have to bring a sacrifice. Now, the sacrifices can get confusing because they're different sacrifices. We are not here talking about the Pesach sacrifice. That's a different one. There is a Pesach sacrifice which is brought not on Pesach. It's brought when?
14th.
Erev Pesach. The day before Pesach is when it's brought. It's eaten the night of Pesach at the Seder, but it is sacrificed on the 14th of Adar, of Nisan in the afternoon. That's when it's sacrificed. There is another requirement that when you are Ola Regel, when you go up to Yerushalayim, you have to bring another sacrifice with you to be brought in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, there's a big difference between the Pesach sacrifice and what is called the Olas Re'iyah. The Ola is a completely burned offering, and Re'iyah means of seeing, from this verse here. Lo Yeira'u Fanai Re'ekam, they shall not see my face empty. You got to bring something with you, bring a gift. There's a big difference. And the big difference is this. The Pesach sacrifice, every single Jew is required to do unless they're physically unable to do it. That means men and women are obligated in the Pesach sacrifice. That's right, the Pesach Seder, not only are men required to eat, the Afikomen, women are also required to eat the Afikomen, because the Afikomen today is the replacement for the sacrifice. In the time of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, it should be built speedily in our days. We won't be eating matzah for Afikomen, we'll be eating the Pesach sacrifice with matzah for the Afikomen. But the Pesach sacrifice is the actual real thing you're supposed to be eating at that time of the Seder. That is a requirement on both men and women. But the requirement to go to Yerushalayim 3 times a year for the 3 festivals is only a requirement on men. Of course, women can come if they wish, but they are not required to. So it turns out that Pesach is a much more crowded holiday in Yerushalayim, because women have to come as well, because there's the Pesach sacrifice. But Shavuos and Sukkot, only the men need to come. Not only that, but Pesach, a woman could go home after the first day of Pesach. She can go back home. She doesn't have to stay the whole time. But the men need to be there in Yerushalayim. So there's a requirement for men to be Olat Regel, to go up to Yerushalayim. Well, women don't have that requirement except for the Pesach sacrifice. Therefore, the requirement to bring another sacrifice with you, the Olas Re'ia, that special Ola sacrifice, which is brought for coming for the holiday, that's only a requirement on men. Women are not required for that extra sacrifice. There's a difference in that as well. Okay. Pasuk Tes Zion, verse 16. Now we move on to Shavuos. V'chag ha-katsir. That's the holiday of harvesting. Bikurei ma'asecha. The first fruits of your labor. Asher tizra ba'asadeh, that you plant in the field. So it was the Bikurim, the first fruits, were brought to Yerushalayim no earlier than Shavuos. Shavuos is the first time of the year where you can bring Bikurim, the first fruits, up to Yerushalayim. The first fruits do not need to be brought on Shavuos. They could be brought any time between Shavuos and Sukkot. But the most common time to bring it would be Shavuos, because that's when they're ripe and beautiful and fresh. And that would be the time to bring them. Yeah.
It occurs to me, what about during a Shemitah year?
Okay, excellent. Good. So the halacha is that even in a Shemitah year, there's a requirement of Bikurim. Now, in a Shemitah year, you're not allowed to hoard the fruit. So Rashi explains that in a Shemitah year, you go out to the field when things start to ripen, and you tie a string around those things that ripen first to indicate to people that that is the Bikurim fruit. So they shouldn't eat it. And then you take them up to Yerushalayim. But even in a Shemitah year, there is a requirement of Bikurim.
How many fruits were there?
It's the seven fruits of Eretz Yisrael.
How many fruits did that mean?
How many do you have to bring? You know, I don't know the answer to that question. That's a good question. Like, how many grapes?
Right.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know the answer. That's a good question. I don't know. V'chag ha'asif b'tzeis ha'ashana, and the holiday of gathering as the year goes out. Then when you gather your labor from the field, because that by then all of the produce had dried in the field, whatever needed to be dried had dried, and now it could be brought in, and it could be milled, etc., and be made it into, ready to eat. Yeah.
Why did it refer to the close of the year?
Excellent. Because
it's the beginning of the year, and it's Pesach, and it's still not.
Okay, so you anticipated my question. So, good, excellent. So, this is an excellent question. Isn't Rosh Hashanah the beginning of the year, and Sukkot comes 15 days after Rosh Hashanah? So why is it being called the close of the year?
It's the close of the season. Pesach was the first of the year.
Okay. So we Jews, not only do we have 2 different celestial ways of dealing with the calendar, astronomical ways of dealing with the calendar, but even when we count the months, we have different ways of doing it. Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah, is the beginning of the year for the world. But Nisan is the beginning of the year for the Jews. So Nisan is our first month. Now, even if you say that, still Tishrei is not the end of the year. If anything, Adar is the end of the year, right before Nisan. So it's a little funny to call Tishrei the end of the year, or the going out of the year. But as far as the holiday season is concerned, we count it as Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot. Sukkot marks the end of that. Even if you look at it from a Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot perspective, Sukkot is the end. Sukkot marks the end of the cycle of holidays on the calendar. When you enter the winter, except for, of course, Hanukkah and Purim, both of which are rabbinic in nature, not Torah holidays, from Sukkot all the way to Pesach, you don't have any Torah holiday. So it's considered to be the end of that cycle or that system. The Torah then adds, Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17, Shalosh Pi'amim Bashanah, three times a year, Ye'ro'echo Zochurecha, all of your males shall be seen. Here's where it says the males shall be seen. Es El Pnei Ha'adon Hashem, to the face of the Master Hashem. So we need to be seen in Yerushalayim. So you have to picture the analogy is, let's say you have a general or a prime minister or a president that wants to see the soldiers on parade. So everybody's got to be seen by whoever's in charge. It's not that they need to see him. He wants to see the parade, the soldiers. So we need to go to Yerushalayim to be seen by Hashem. And that, of course, he could see us wherever we are. But conceptually what's happening is that Hashem is in his seat of the capital, which is Yerushalayim, the Beis HaMikdash, and we are expected to be seen by him in that place. And that's the idea of going three times a year to Yerushalayim. Yod Ches 18, Lo Sizbach Al Chameitz Dam Zivchi, don't, is it a slaughter or a sacrifice?
Offer.
Don't offer the blood, okay. Of the blood of my sacrifice with Chametz, and the fat of my sacrifice shall not stay over till the morning. So this is two different laws regarding the Pesach sacrifice. So all of a sudden we've switched over to the Pesach sacrifice. And what it's telling you is that we know that you can't have chametz on Pesach. We're all aware of that. So as soon as Pesach starts, you obviously can't eat any chametz. But we also know that we have to get rid of our chametz before midday on Erev Pesach. On the 14th of Nisan, there's a time by which you have to burn the chametz. And that's prior to midday. It's actually an hour or two prior to the middle of the day. You have to get rid of the chametz. Why? It's not Pesach yet. Well, after you burn the chametz, there's a good 6, 7, 8 hours till Pesach starts. So why do we need to get rid of the chametz already in the morning? That makes it very inconvenient. Why do we need to do that? So this is why, right here. Because we have to rid ourselves of the chametz prior to the time when it is appropriate to offer the Pesach sacrifice. You can't have chametz in your possession when it is time to offer the Pesach sacrifice. When is it appropriate to offer the Pesach sacrifice? The afternoon of the 14th of Nisan. You can't offer the Pesach sacrifice in the morning of the 14th of Nisan, and you can't offer the Pesach sacrifice after nightfall. It has to be in the afternoon, that means after midday, but before sunset, on the 14th of Nisan. It's a very small time frame for thousands upon thousands of sacrifices that have to be brought. That's why we've talked about this before, that although the entire year the Beis HaMikdash ran with shifts, for the Kohanim, there was a 24 groups that had different, each one took a week, and then it started over again. In the Beis HaMikdash, each family took another week, but the Erev Pesach, the day before Pesach, the 14th of Nisan, that was all hands on deck. Every Kohen, every able-bodied Kohen had to be in the Beis HaMikdash. It didn't matter when your shift was, you were needed on the 14th of Pesach. Of 14th of Nisan, because they had to process thousands upon thousands of sheep and goats for the Pesach sacrifice, because that's the only time it can be done during those little less than 6 hours. That's all you got. So we need to rid ourselves of the chametz prior to that time, which is midday on the 14th. And of course, as with all laws, since chametz is such a serious law, the sages backed us up a little bit. So instead of letting us go right up to the wire of exactly midday, they backed us up 2 hours, and that's why when you see the printed time for getting rid of the chametz, there's a printed time by which you can eat chametz, and then a later time by which you can burn the chametz. The eating of the chametz is up to 2 hours before midday, and the burning of the chametz is up to 1 hour before midday. Midday is the actual Torah cutoff time, and the rabbinic cutoff time is an hour or two earlier, depending if you're talking about eating or ridding yourself of the chametz. And the second half of that pasuk, the second half of the verse is that the fat of the sacrifice should not stay over till morning. So the fat of the Pesach sacrifice needed to be burned. The fats that were not eaten needed to be burned. The Pesach sacrifice, the part that had to be eaten was eaten by the people who brought the sacrifice. But then there are parts of every sacrifice that need to be burned on the altar. The fats are one of those things that has to be burned. So the Torah is telling us that the burning, those things that need to be burned, should not stay overnight. They need to be burned by morning. Before sunrise, they have to have burned on the altar. That's what it's telling you over here. So even though the sacrifice was slaughtered, it was offered, and the blood was thrown during that very intense afternoon before Pesach, and then that night is when it's eaten with the Pesach Seder, but the burning of those fats could go on all night. Now, it wasn't that the Kohanim had to stay up all night doing it. They had a big fire, and they put it in the fire, and it burned all night. This does not mean that if there was a piece that didn't burn by morning, that it was a problem. What it means is that it has to be put on top of the altar in the fire before morning. But as long as that's where it is, even if it's not fully consumed by the fire, by the time sun rises, that's okay. The point over here is that the fats can't remain off of the altar, off of the Mizbeach, by the time sunrise comes. It has to be on top of the altar and being burned. And the last verse here, Yud-Tes 19, Reishis Bikurei Ad Mascha Tavi Beis Hashem Elokecha. Here's the mitzvah of Bikurim, the first of the first fruits of your labor, of your land, should be brought to the house of Hashem your God. That's Bikurim. You bring it up and you give it to the Kohen. And finally, Lo Sivashel Gidi Bachalev Imo, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. This is the first of three times it's mentioned in the Torah. The reason it's mentioned three times, our sages tell us, is to teach us that there are three different prohibitions. We cannot eat milk and meat together. We cannot derive any benefit from milk and meat together, not just not eat it. But if you have milk and meat, you can't feed it to your dog, because you can't derive benefit from it either. And you cannot even cook milk and meat together, which means that if your next door neighbor, who is not Jewish, asks you if you would please cook this milk and meat together, you can't do it, even though you don't plan on eating it, and you're not going to derive any benefit from it, but you still cannot even cook it together. Three different prohibitions: eating, deriving benefit, and cooking. Can't do. The Torah expresses it as not cooking a kid in its mother's milk. Our sages explain that a kid over here does not only mean a sheep or a goat, but it also can mean a calf. It can mean any kind. It can mean an adult animal or an adult sheep, goat, or cow, or a baby. It doesn't make a difference. And it doesn't have to be its mother's milk. It's any milk would be a problem. Any milk from a behema, from sheep, goats, or cows, from any of those families. Any meat and milk from those families cannot be cooked together. Why does it express it as a kid in its mother's milk? This teaches us that only a species of animal that its mother produces milk is included in this prohibition. But a species of animal that its mother does not produce milk would not be included in this prohibition. That is why chicken, fowl, is not poultry. Is not included in the prohibition of milk and meat according to the Torah. That's a rabbinic addition to the prohibition of milk and meat, because birds do not produce milk. It's only milk-producing animals that are included in this prohibition, and that is that would be the sheep, the goats, and the cows. In addition, although you don't see that from here, but a chaya, which is a what we would call loosely a wild animal, like deer, which is kosher, is also not included in this prohibition. It is rabbinic in nature. So that fowl and chaya, deer, wild animals, would only be rabbinic in this prohibition. That is significant when it comes to situations not to eat it. You can't eat them because, just like you can't eat things that are prohibited by the Torah, you can't eat things that are prohibited by the rabbis either. But the rabbis were more lenient when it comes to the cooking and deriving benefit aspects of those things. So that if you have beef and milk cooked together, beef and cheese cooked together, you can't eat it, you can't feed it to your dog. If you have chicken and cheese cooked together, there are more leniencies. I'm not telling you should do it, but it's saying there are more leniencies in those situations because it's only rabbinic in nature, it's not a Torah prohibition. Thank you, thank you. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.